My right thumb can make a proper straight thumbs up, but my left thumb is fucking weird.
How far can you go with that? Like, the furthest?
No, it goes. I didn't make that. I just meant that I can make the straight.
It's probably
thumb.
Because you kept sticking that thumb up too many people's asses.
Welcome, guys. This is the second episode of Red Switch, the podcast. My name is Oiva. And next to me, I have Adamia.
Hello.
And then Suresh.
Hey.
And Bart.
Hello.
That's cool. We'll
just... Now, that was the Red Switch podcast. Thanks for coming. Tune in next week.
Did you have anything you want to
start with?
Okay. Should we start with something funny?
Let's start with something funny. Do you have any?
No. Funniness needs to come in, like the way.
Because I was told that
funniness does have to.
We need to
get
the audience like that's what I was told. Like it was just sort of like too.
Yeah.
Formal.
Okay. Let's start with
what's pissed anyone off this week.
Let's not talk about exams that people don't care about.
Let's start with some follow up. What has the feedback been generally from the first episode? What can we do?
What was it?
I got feedback, like, you introduced a very interesting topic of, like, did you think you'd destined into your field or area of study? And then you answered very nicely to that, and Adamia too, and then I just kind of, like, I don't know, thrashed the entire topic. I didn't really answer to it. But I
guess, that was a shame, actually.
I guess my response was a little bad, but... my opinion just was on that topic that I don't think there's such a thing as destined to be some profession. It's a very old way, in my opinion, to think about professions or like life in general.
Well,
my opinion.
If I remember correctly, I didn't think of it as talking about destiny. It was more that when you look at yourself, and everyone has some kind of understanding of who they are. I was just asking, like, what is that closely linked to what we're doing? And in the case of Suresh, it very much was. You think you're quite, you were kind of destined to go into engineering as a thing. Like it was a natural progression from what he did when he was younger, who he thought he was, and if you'd now describe to someone else who you are, engineering would come up in that explanation.
Definitely.
So it's not really destiny as much as just sort of associating who you are with your field. Whilst I feel like I might be less inclined to associate who I am with maths or computer science. Mm. Maybe computer science, but maths is more a thing that I study, but I don't see it as a real defining characteristic of me.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it was... maybe I got just... carried away once Suresh kind of gave a chronological view on it. Like, since he's been small, he's been into breaking up stuff and restructuring it, which is quite nice.
To an extent.
Yeah.
Making things worse, what did he say?
Attempting to improve stuff and ending up with something that does much less.
I was also told that we should... engage topics like quick, sharp, make them funny. Well, not make them funny, just like humorous and lighthearted, and then slowly move into something.
There's a lot we can do in regards to introducing a topic as sort of briefly as possible. Just saying, let's talk about this. One sentence, two sentences, and then we just go for it. We
exactly.
Like go on a roll. Then
did any of you guys watch the Top Gear episode? I don't know.
Oh, the new one?
The new one.
Who's in it now?
It's Chris Evans and Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc?
Yeah, that is... But to be fair, Chris... They've got Matt LeBlanc, who's an ex-Hollywood star, and Chris Evans, who's a radio presenter primarily, and they've kind of bunged them two together in this show to, like... And it's... Basically, the general consensus is it was terrible. And I watched it, and it was cringeworthy, terrible, because what they're trying to do is force chemistry upon.
Yeah.
Because when the original Top Gear started, they picked a presenter, Jeremy Clarkson, and he picked his mates to just come on with him. And it was just a bit of a laugh. It wasn't, like, you know, anything serious. And they're supposed to do a car show, but they just ended up, you know, messing about. But now they've got like Chris Evans and Matt LeBlanc, and it's just, you could see the full sort of the chemistry trying to be like forced onto upon them.
Yeah, it has to be a bunch of men.
Yeah, and they've just, and it was terrible. And then there was this amazing moment where so many people said hate to Chris Evans, and he just started like, he completely lost it on Twitter, and he's like, you know, he started stating facts because they're like, oh, more people watched this episode than the last season's first episode. But most people responding with like, well, they want to see it because it's your first episode. Obviously, more people will watch it. It's just that everyone hated it.
What I always thought was crazy about Top Gear is it's not, in my mind, it's not something that's exclusively for people who like cars. I'm not particularly interested in cars, but I thought Top Gear was always extremely entertaining.
Yeah.
Because there's something really, like, stupid about it. It's just, like, three morons, like, trying to make fun of each other and competing against each other in really, like, stupid competitions where they actually play with the worst of cars, not really the best ones, yeah. Where they, like, demolish themselves on road trips and shit like that.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's really funny. And it's a delicate format. It's so, like, it's very closely associated with the people that were in it.
Yeah.
It was, like, it wouldn't be the same if you just swap out the people.
Yeah. Chris Evans was completely wrong for the show. He was, every time, like, he was trying to get fake involved in the people going, oh, yeah! When, like, he's in a car and you're just like, oh, please, buddy, give it a rest. Like,
yeah.
It was horrible. And there's an amazing interview where they're like, so, like, they ask James, like, what happened? And he's like, James Whale was just like, yeah, Jeremy's a knob, but I like him.
That's the whole show.
Yeah, they just hate each other, but they're mates. That's what mates do, don't they?
Yeah.
And then they're going to create this Amazon thing where they're just going to go and they're going to
They've been bought by Amazon or Netflix or
the
something.
No, it's Amazon, and they're going to call it the Grand Tour now. It's coming out quite.
So, same thing.
Yeah, basically them three are just going to go around the world. So you know those road trips they used to do like every once in a while on Top Gear? Now they're going to like do three seasons.
Oh, that's cool.
8 episodes each. Nice. Of just going around the world and just messing about.
But it's like a good thing because now they have like a bit of a change going.
Yeah, well they wanted to call it Gear Knobs, but Top Gear like, no, you can't have that. That's too close to Top Gear.
Gear Knobs, but it's still not Top Gear, right?
No, but yeah, it's like naming rights and stuff, aren't they? Yeah.
I don't know if you can do that.
BBC kind of, I think, messed up. There was like the biggest source of income for BBC, I think, Top Gear was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like a hard position for them as well. It's like if you punch
they
the
Yeah, they'd get a... Yeah. BBC would get a lot of hate about sort of having no backbone if they just allow that to happen.
BBC,
just
BBC
because,
already get hate.
Just because they... just because they want to keep their most glamorous show going, that they're considering to sort of swipe under the rug the fact that one of the hosts is going around punching a producer. That's...
He's not going around just punching every
producer. Hey, how are you doing today?
He's just going around punching producers.
No, you get what I mean. If they just are fine with that kind of behaviour, that's showing that, you know, if you're famous enough, if you're big enough as a star, you can get away with anything. And that's the critique that sort of BBC was getting, is that, you know, they're okay, they're just sort of standing by and letting
it
happen.
I'm
you know?
Completely on BBC here, like, I couldn't care less for these kind of, like, big shots. Like, they act too pompous anyway.
Mm. Yeah, fair enough. I can see what they did as well. But still, it is biting the hand that feeds them a little bit.
You know what I want to talk about?
What's up?
This past week, well, we're all in our sort of exam season in
Not
our
sort
year
of,
at the moment.
We are.
We are.
Mm-hmm.
Us three, with you know, all with the exception of Suresh, we're in our first year. Suresh, you're in like 18th year, seven.
Fifth.
Yep. It's crazy, man. It's crazy.
It's a double degree.
Yeah. So did you start your
2012?
No. Did you start your like degree when you were like 15 or something?
Well, I'm 23 now, so no.
Okay.
I'm not that smart.
So we're all in our exam season, and this thing that always kind of confuses me is how people act and behave in exam seasons, because people get stressed, and I don't know why they get stressed in this very irrational sort of hyperbole way. But they keep on acting as if, like, they're completely screwed, they're gonna fail the year, it's all terrible. And I don't get it. sort of the, and you know, first of all, yeah, that's my first reaction is, oh, it's like, why are you acting that way? This is just stress for no reason, and it's just kind of stupid and it's annoying. But then I get to thinking and I move on from this just simple opinion or whatever, and I'm like, okay, what, where does this stress come from? How do people manage to get really stressed? And my personal theory is that stress is a product of uncertainties. What I mean with that is, if you're in a, in like a an exam season and whatever, it's not the work that you have to do or the exams that you have to sit that are stressing people out. It's the uncertainties that come along with them. One uncertainty would be you don't know what's on the exam. Another uncertainty might be that you don't know the sort of what you got to learn. You haven't organized out how you're going to do everything in the right amount of time, so your time planning is uncertain. Every point along the way, when it comes to doing exams, there are places where you can fit in a little bit of uncertainty, where you can make it slightly sort of iffy, where you're kind of not on solid ground. And at any point that you do that, you're going to become more stressed. So stress is just comes from not knowing how to plan your time, not knowing what to do when you, with your time, not knowing what's on the exams, not knowing what you have to get from the exams.
No, I think it's more of a social thing, dude. No one likes a guy who's like, you know what, I'm going to ace this exam. Everyone hates that dude who's like, oh yeah, this is going to be easy, and you're just sitting there.
That's not what I mean. Let me complete it. The reason why I bring this up is that in the past week, I think I found a really great way of getting rid of most of the stress that I had. And the way I did that was going kind of back to front instead of front to back in terms of revision. I started from what do I need at the end of the year, then went a bit back again to what would I need in this exam, then I went back to how much do I need to revise to get at least that, and then I was very directed and sort of could work a lot better because I knew exactly how much I needed to do, and I knew exactly how much I needed in an exam, and I had ways of quantifying how my progress was going, because I knew that, okay, on this day I did a paper and I got about 20%, next day I did one and got 30, and I can see the progress, and I can see the goal being, say, 55 or 60% in that paper. I can see how it's going from day to day, and I've gotten rid of lots of uncertainties along the way. Uncertainties that I did have before. I didn't know how much I had to get in this exam for me to realistically get the result I want at the end of the year. I didn't know what I had to revise or how much of one subject I really needed to revise in order to get that grade. But by starting all the way at the end result and working my way backwards, I'm now in a situation where I feel practically no stress at all. Because I know exactly, you know, I can invest a bit of time here, I can invest a bit of time there. And it's working really well instead of me just sitting around so sort of unorganized, so disorganized that I don't know where to begin, and I end up doing far less work than the work I'm doing now. That's what I mean with stress comes from uncertainty.
Okay. Well, when people just, I think that's over-analysis of it. Like, you've thought about this way too much.
You've got way too much time. You know, when you have too much time on your hand, when you're like, in the exam period, you're like, let's go all the way back to the beginning of the year and analyse it completely.
This is it. You should have been doing a past paper when you're doing that shit. I think it's just like, if you're going around to people and be like, I'm so stressed. I mean, I'm so good for this exam, it's going to be so easy, I'm sorted. And for people who've done jack shit throughout the year, they're going to be like, this guy's a dick, just showing off, he's just like, oh, I'm so good, I'm so smart, yada, yada, yada. It's just like a social thing. You don't go to people like, I'm really good, how are you feeling for the exam? And then they're like, oh, not too good, but like, well, I'm going fucking fantastic, so screw you. It's just like you sort of just share their worries and stuff with them as well. And also, people also stress because they haven't done, like, the actual work throughout the year. And so there comes a point where, like, have I done enough to pass a subject? Like, have I done this to pass? Like, it is uncertainty, but it's more like they just want to make sure they get what they're getting, and because they just feel like they haven't done enough, I guess. Oh, wait, that is uncertainty, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It comes back to my theory. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I was getting a bit sort of annoyed at a friend on my course who keeps on going on about how he's going to fail the year. And it really upsets me because, you know, I don't want to see him fail. But most of all, he's not. Like, he's not in as bad a position as he thinks. And so I went to his dorm yesterday, sat down with him, and, like, created a spreadsheet of all of the grades he has, all of the grades he need to get to pass the year, and it's fine. Like, he could fail almost all of the upcoming exams, and he'd still pass. And, like, not fail at, like, 40%. I mean 0% on most of these exams, and he'd pass. And then he'd been going on the days before about how he's, you know, in such a bad position, you've got to fail, and it's a, that attitude just comes from the fact that he had no clue what he was going to get. He just thought that any bad grade on, like, one of the exams would result in failing the year, which is not true. And just showing him, this is what you need to do, that's the one important exam, the rest are not important, for example, but just pinpointing what he actually needs to do, he can spend 1 hour a day doing that. Like, that's nothing. And he can pass the year, and he can get even a good grade. Now he can think not only about passing the year, but he can think about sort of being more ambitious and getting a good grade at the end of the year, or getting a 2-2 or a 2-1. That kind of thinking is just comes from getting rid of that uncertainty, getting rid of that terrible attitude that they have. And then you can actually do stuff. And you could say, oh yeah, you should have spent that time doing past papers instead. You've been thinking way too into this. And I don't get that either. I don't understand where you're coming from that, because I'm investing time now into something that's not directly helping my studies to then almost supercharge the work I can do afterwards. And that's, you know, that's how, you know, that's the whole idea of a tool. You spend some time building a tool so that for all the time afterwards, you're 10 times more efficient. And yeah, you've got some time that you might consider that, you know, you're wasting your time building that tool, but eventually you're actually being far more productive as a consequence of that. And I feel like my revision has been far more productive since writing up all of this, figuring out exactly what my grade should be, even though that took me an hour or two. Those hour or two were maybe the best 2 hours I could have spent for the entire exam season.
Yeah, fair enough. I can agree with that. Also, but like the opposite's true as well, where if you do that, you sort of get complacent with what you need to do as well. Do you know what I mean? You start saying, that's all I need to do, so you sort of just strive for something. But if you're sort of deluded a little bit, like, I have to do a lot more work, you sort of push yourself to do heaps where you didn't actually need to, and you could also achieve a higher mark there. I found when I've done similar things to you, I sort of get content with my plan. So I've always had to sort of delude myself a bit. Like, I need to do really well here, otherwise I'm going to do badly. And that way, my mind's just like, shit. Then I start doing heaps of work. So I need stress to do well. Otherwise, I'm just too content and I don't care about anything. So I work with stress.
I think that works good at the beginning of the year when you're trying to maximum. But I think near the end of the year, you need to kind of like be a bit more realistic, because at the end of the year, you can't really be like, there's three exams in a row. You can't be like, I'm going to put my maximum effort in all three of them and like sit on a module and just try and do all of it. Because it's literally time that's a problem.
No.
So you're like, going to try and like get to the point where you're like, okay, I'm getting this in the paper, I'm going to stop that, move on to the next one, and because I know what I need in every paper.
I completely agree with Suresh on this one, where you do get complacent with it. Once you know exactly what you need, I think you tend to become less ambitious.
Yeah.
Because you've got this idea that not only can you try and get a good grade, but you don't have to if you're a bit tired that day. You can always fall back to the easier plan.
Yeah.
So when ambition and when excellence is just an option that you can take, and it's not the thing you need to do, because you've made it clear to yourself what you could actually do instead, then I think a lot of people, and maybe me in the end, would just fall back to the easier option, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Because I've done that. Like, I'm also realistic about what I'm going to get. I know I'm going to pass. Usually I know I'll pass everything. But I usually want to make sure I get, like, a decent mark. Right? And I do set my time out decently for everything. But I still want to be a little bit deluded about how well I'm going to do in each subject, so I can just push myself a little bit more. And also having good competition helps as well. Just having others saying, yeah, I'm doing pretty well. You're like, shit, got to pick up my game.
Yeah.
You want to talk about something else, man?
Right, let's talk about Sam Harris's TED Talk. And I'll put this somewhere in the description for the podcast.
What was the topic? Science.
Shall I?
Science can answer moral values. Was that?
Yeah. Okay. So, Sam Harris presented a TED Talk at some point. I don't know if it was recent. 2010. So not very recent. Saying that science can answer moral questions, which is relatively controversial, I'd say. And he goes into depth by saying, and sort of relatively, sort of, if I can summarize it, because it's quite a long talk, it'll basically be that there isn't an answer to every moral question that is objective, sure. But there are some ways, he believes, that you can answer some of the questions. You can say that in particular cases, it's objectively bad of a moral sort of thing, sort of killing lots of people or raping someone. There's almost objective ways we can prove that that's bad. And there are also, and I don't know if he really argued this, but there might also be places where you can objectively say that a certain way of interacting with people and certain morals that you might have are objectively good, and that there's some kind of way of backing up through science, and since he's coming from a neurology background, he'll even say that you can back it up by just inspecting what's happening inside people's brains to say, okay, this is a happy person and it's not a happy person.
You mean by reducing into, like,
conscious... You could call that reducing as well, yeah.
Reducing into conscious effects, yes.
So I highly recommend listening to the talk. You might even want to go away from this podcast for a bit and watch that talk. We'll make sure to put it somewhere near the description or on the podcast page. So if you want to have a quick link to it, you'll find it there. Now, thoughts on this podcast?
Well, I'm just going to throw it out there.
On this podcast.
Thoughts on on the talk, yeah. Oiva.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw that out there. You said he goes in depth. I don't think he does really go in depth. He just... he's talking about universal objective moralities and then going about assessing those. But what he does, he gives particular examples and then contrasts those to his ideals, his views on the issues. And that's basically what he does. I wouldn't call that in-depth. In some ways, they're very superficial. And he also goes to the point where he calls other civilizations unsophisticated, which is extremely unsophisticated thing to say.
Yeah, I guess so. But let's bring up one of the examples he gave, so that we're not just speaking sort of in this bubble of sort of without connecting it to the real world. The one of the primary examples he gave was comparing our society and sort of how women's bodies are sort of restricted.
Wait a second. Our society, you mean American society or the US society?
Yeah, it's relatively similar on this topic, where sort of the magazines you see nowadays have women practically naked on the cover, and it's this extremely sort of sexualized, you could consider it over-sexualized.
And men
as well. But predominantly women.
He doesn't mention men, so...
He was, yeah, let's just stick with his example. But he was comparing that to, I don't know which country, but one where all the women were forced to wear veils. And where it's almost the opposite of this over-sexualizing. It's stopping any sexualization of women, sort of the ultimate modesty, in some sense. And he was comparing those two and saying, you know, both of these are not very good. They're bad things about them. But somewhere in the middle, there is a better way to treat women or allow women to express themselves that leads to a society that is better off overall. Yeah,
you mean two extremes, right?
Mm. Yeah. But by saying that, by agreeing that they're two extremes, could we say that that's not just an opinion, but there's some way of maybe objectively speaking, that both of these are going to lead to societies that aren't very well off. That we kind of have to work on fixing these things and making society fit perfectly between that, that we allow women to express themselves, but we don't have the media going off, sort of going to this extreme of over-sexualization, and we don't try to control them where we go to this extreme of complete modesty. And I think he had a very good point there, that there is something objectively bad about either of those options, either of those extremes. And objectively, I mean that, yeah, there is universally, they're both not very good options. It's not a cultural thing. It's not that, you know, it might work in one culture, it might not work in another. I do agree with him that across the board, universally, regardless of whatever culture, that is morally not the best option. And there are better ways you could organize or set up a culture.
Yeah, he brings that up to, should we bring like children and have children be educated in a world like that? On the first extreme, there's sort of a very over-sexualized view on women, obviously. And then there's the other one where, yeah, women are voluntarily clothing, have burqas and those sort of clothes on. But then he just goes on and says that it's not actually voluntary.
Do you disagree with that?
I don't know.
Voluntary, I'm pretty sure.
I can agree. Even if it wasn't, it was voluntary. And I put that in inverted commas. This, like, there's sort of a pressure to have it anyway. So even if you're saying that it's voluntary, it's still not voluntary. Because, like, as you said, you're looked at in a certain way if you don't wear it.
In those countries, yeah. It's not voluntary. There's no, like, you can't voluntarily not wear that. That's just the rule.
Mm.
He's talked about, you know, acid being thrown on their faces if they don't wear it. But I don't know, like, I think the talk itself, I think he said a lot without saying nothing much. I think he kind of...
I can agree with that.
I think he very much sort of touched upon little points and then just went off them and just made and gave another example. And he didn't really go in depth, and I didn't really enjoy that part of it. So he made some points that were good. So when he talked about the, you know, the fact that people talk about gay marriage or these little things, and they're worse, they are what he claimed, worst problems on this earth, like, you know, genocide and stuff like that. So he made a good point, but then he didn't extrapolate on it, and he just left that topic and just went on to another topic. It almost felt like that talk, he had a lot to say, and he wanted to get all in 25 minutes when he probably needed to only get set up one thing and really extrapolate on that one point. And I don't think he did that, which gave off a slightly bad look, because, you know, when the guy who came to question him, he looked kind of pissed off, didn't he? When the guy came on to, like, do a Q&A, he was just like, oh, twat.
Yeah, you are, actually. That wasn't a good TED talk.
Yeah, I think...
It's just too much of nothing.
Yeah.
It, and it's got nothing to do with the fact that I agree or disagree with him, because I happen to agree with him. Wava, you happen to kind of disagree with him. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No.
Effectively, it's just not a very good TED talk, because that's not the best place to express... I'd say a relatively complicated idea that can, you know, it there are many tangents you can go off on that are all very important and sort of add to the complexity of things, and trying to boil that down to 25 minutes
There's one positive thing I wanted to say about him. He did a good I enjoyed his view on how science can give answers to moral questions, like what sort of an economical system is good for us. Does an economical system increase our well-being? Well, that's most likely. And I think that was a good thing. And he also believed that if we go further in life, progress towards this point where moral questions are a lot better, the science can give us answers for that. But it's just saying that he's still in one society, or like one civilization, and then he calls his civilization sophisticated. That's incredibly contradictory.
Did he use those words? Or did he use civilized?
Yeah, he did.
Who's sophisticated and unsophisticated.
Okay, I can... yeah, civilized. He's a civilized.
Yeah.
But he's also talking, like, his society is over-sexualizing women. That's not exactly civilized, unless that's his opinion of civilized society. And also he's bringing up the gay discussion, the gay problem.
He brought up a lot of things, though, and he didn't extrapolate upon them, which is what made it a bad talk. When you were trying to explain what happened in the talk, you struggled because you're like, what really did he make? So it's when I think of a TED talk, I think after it, you have like a point to discuss. It's like a question. You're like, what is this? After coming from that TED talk, you're like, oh, it said a lot of things. Yeah. And we can discuss it, but we can only discuss it for about 20 seconds because they didn't really say much about them.
That's the thing. When you're like, let's talk about that, I was like, what am I going to talk about? Because I have no idea what where to direct my conversation.
So it's almost become what makes a good TED talk.
Yeah. This is not a good... Like
No.
At the end, I think you have to have a clear idea of, like, that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
And you've backed up that one main opinion that he's pushing, or idea that he's pushing, with relatively good reasoning. Here, he's backing something, but he didn't want to make too wild an idea because he didn't want to get any backlash from it. Because I feel like subtle. He had that pressure.
It's subtle. Yeah. I can see his point. He introduces it, but then he leaves it. And that point, in my opinion, was... this is an objective opinion right now. And you can surely agree with me. Science can give moral answers. There's... fine and good, okay. But that's not the end of the discussion. The moral answers are not only the problem of science. They are a lot vaster problem. It's a lot broader problem, and it's definitely not only science that will give us that answer, or answers for that. But I think Sam Harris was pretty one-sided with this. And he also expressed this idea where science had a moral high ground. And furthermore, that the West and the point where we are right now, we've progressed to a point where the Western society has the moral high ground and knows what's a sophisticated civilization and can give these moral objectives. But that's not true. You can study like... ancient classical society where gay sexuality was definitely a big thing. People didn't frown upon that. It wasn't a big problem or a big question, but in the Western society there still is. And I don't think that's going to be a scientific question either. Like, what's science going to say about gay sexuality?
I think we all made, like, obviously, maybe not all of us, but, like, made, like, slideshows, like, for school or whatever. And you know when the teacher normally checks whether, like, you know, there's nothing rude in the actual slideshow, and there's, like, not, like, a penis pic or something. So they normally... But the thing is, if there's, like, let's say there's a 30-page slideshow, they only check the first 5 or 6. They're like, oh, it's all fine. And they just let you go. I think what he did for the TED Talk, I think, generally presenting this is my TED Talk, and the guy was just scanned through, like, first 2-3 pages, and he's like, oh, it's just about, you know, this. So what he did, for the first about 6-7 minutes, he talked about this broader topic, and then he tried to focus on, like, what he really wanted to talk about was Islam, wasn't he? Because that's what he was getting upon, I think. Because he was always kept coming back to the burqa thing, and he kept coming back to the fact, and even the questions were about, you know, and I felt like he almost created a TED Talk just to talk about a specific viewpoint that he had, rather than...
Exactly. That was
his sort of... His aim was not to talk about the topic, his aim was to talk about what he wanted to talk about, and he didn't want to put that in the title.
Maybe the funny thing about this was that most of his talk was a... rhetorical. Yeah, I know. It was a rhetorical talk. He was kind of an orator. But he was also on a pedestal, and he was given a moral high ground or moral questions with a scientific background.
Yeah, I agree with you, Damio, that like he really did want to just get at Islam or get at that culture specifically, which I thought was a shame, because as much as that's relevant to the conversation, halfway through when he kind of raised these points already, I was like, okay, great, you've given me reason to believe sort of your idea that, you know, some moral choices can be answered objectively with science. I want you to now talk more about that. I want you to get to that main point and like, you've got me on, I'm on your side here. I agree. Now talk about that. But the whole talk was a justification for that idea and not an exploration of it. So it's kind of a shame that all he wanted to do was really kind of push this idea underneath of this anti-Islam or that culture. Instead of the idea that was actually really interesting, that he got everyone to... That was the thing he sold as the title of the TED Talk, to get everyone in.
Yeah.
That idea was the thing that I actually wanted to hear about. But instead, he was using that idea to then sort of punch holes in other people's cultures.
If I was a Sam Harris fan, I would enjoy that talk. If I was a person that went to watch that thing or based on the title, I'd be left sort of wanting and disappointed, saying I wanted more from that talk. Because it seems like... obviously, Sam Harris is a well-read individual. He's done a lot of reading and he's got points... And he said he's not a scientist, he's not a physicist, and he hasn't got that much. That amazing science knowledge that some people have. So it's very much taught, like, really specific about these sort of Judeo-Christian religions, those where he argues against them, primarily. And at the beginning of the talk, he was talking about the science stuff. It felt like he just read this somewhere, or like he got told this. And then he just wanted to go into, like, what he really wanted. Like, this is why I'm really here. And that you could really see that by the end of the talk, when he asked the Q&A. And the guy asked him, if the science comes out and it does say that they love their daughters equally, what would you do? And he's like, oh, I still wouldn't accept it. And then he gave a reasoning for that. I'm like, come on, you can't do that. Like,
very good point. Yeah, that's the whole point of science. If you're a real believer in science, is if there's good enough proof to disprove your claim, then you should change your mind.
Yeah.
You change your mind if science does. And he was saying that even if they did prove that, it's just because they're delusional,
yeah,
and therefore like it. And so...
Almost saying that science can't answer everything. That's what
he's
exactly saying.
Because how can science distinguish between someone who's not delusional and who's someone who is? And then we come back to this moral high ground, which you raised, Oliver, where it's, you know, he's standing here with the perspective of being in an American culture, in a Western culture, that he considers civilized and sophisticated. And he's judging others. Oh, great, he pointed out one thing bad in his culture about over-sexualization. But surely that's not the only thing bad about it, and surely you are also speaking from some, you know, you're biased to the culture that you're in. And you know, how can you... And I think it is interesting to think, can you get away from that bias and really think more sort of about morals objectively? And I'd love to say that that's true, but you never know.
Exactly, that was... I think your key point there was when you said... Belief. You use the belief word in science because it's not about belief. It's more about proving stuff right, and that's about knowledge, and that's something true belief. But in my mind, just belief is kind of like a faith. It's kind of like a system of beliefs where you have your opinions, and that was one of the things about him. Like, he's this big guy talking about big topics, talking to a big audience, and the audience is shut. The audience doesn't really say anything. So what he's doing, he's trying to change the opinion of them, but is he doing much else? Like, he's giving his subjective. He should, in a conversation like that, there should be two people, but there's only one person having the conversation.
He had a lot of good points, and you could see that he was like, he's read about it, you know, about Islam, so he had good points about it. But I think he could have gone about it a lot better than bashing it, rather than he could have talked about it as a, you know, almost a person and explaining what they do and be a bit more considerate rather than saying they're not, like, civilized. You know, even if the science comes out, they're deluded. And that was the problem, where he had all these facts and then he opinionized them and he started saying, you know, even if these turn out to be false, I'm not going to, like, stand away from my own opinion, which almost is deluded yourself. You're deluded if you don't believe scientific facts. That is the definition of deluded. So you're calling someone else deluded because the science says they're not. And
when you've defined what it means.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Can we switch to the topic that we've been
on? Yeah, let's do it. Okay, Suresh, you brought up the topic.
If you click on the first link of every main text page in Wikipedia, which is not capitalized, you will eventually find your way into philosophy. And we've tried it, and it only doesn't work with
Adam. Okay,
let
me give you one example of this. or any of you guys, if you just read out each page that you go to as you go through it. Let's find one.
Can we try it on Finland?
Do it. Go from Finland to...
We want to see your country and see if they relate to philosophy. Alright, so the first one is... Seventh state.
Yeah, you got there already.
Yeah, you're already there.
Yeah.
State.
International law. States. Oh, polity. Entity. Exists. being. Objective.
Yep.
Philosophical, I don't think we'll get there. No, we got there. Philosophy.
Okay. Why did you think you got there? To go by concept. I typed in poo into Wikipedia. Feces. Waste. Subjective. Philosophical. Three clicks away. How did they put in waste? The first thing, the term is often subjective, so... There's like subjective, conceptual, these kind of things are one of the first links to the, because they try to describe something, and philosophy is often used to describe some stuff that people know stuff
You about. Might find yourself in an infinite loop, which I found myself when I was trying to go from Steve Jobs to philosophy, and at some point I got to atoms, the first link in that page went to matter, and the first link in the page matter went back to atoms, and so I was just going round and round and round, and I couldn't get anywhere. So that's one of the cases where it doesn't happen.
Like the 6%.
Yeah.
Nice. It's weird though.
That's cool.
Sad.
I think we should call it.
Yeah.
Who's doing the outro?
Oliver.
Me? Why don't you just do it? We had a good run. And that was the red switch.
You say we had a good one. One we're like retiring. We had a good run, guys. We gave it our all.
So that was the red switch. We had a bad run, but.
All right, guys. That was Red Switch the podcast. Thanks for listening.
The site ratemypoo.com.
Rate my what?
Ratemypoo.com.
Pew.
Pew. Poo.
Poo.
Poo. My shit.
Yes.
What? Why?
I don't know. We were just talking crap.
Ratemypoo.com. Let's find this.
It's like a top 10 poo of the world.
Oliver seems the most critical of like internet. Like, he doesn't use Facebook except for the practical stuff. Yeah, you're the only one that comes with the weirdest website ever.
You're the one judging social media.
Come on! Fucking rate my poo is not going to make you feel bad.
Well, that might do if you don't like.
I have to be honest. These are some.
Read these 10 shocking facts that make.
What is that? What is that?
Disgusting.
That is horrible. And that's only number 9.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah.
Oh shit. It's a number 2.
What are you guys? I'm like 4 years old. That shit. It's decades old by now. It's fucking old.
Oh, that's even worse to think about. Oh,
that's a 10-year-old poo.